We're going to be talking in a few minutes to R.O. Bleckman. And as I said, he has a show opening at the Hudson Opera House from 5 to 7 on Saturday night. And we will be talking to him shortly. Can you play a little bit more of that wonderful music?
We're not going to cover up talk anymore.
As we welcome our
guest. No, we're not doing that anymore, remember?
We're just making people incorporate
right.
into
They're joining
the show.
The party.
They're joining the party. Okay, well.
But I will play some.
I'm going to step away from the mic, however.
Oh, really?
Okay. To welcome our guest. And
you don't want to welcome him on the air, like, just as he walks in with the sound of the door opening and all that kind of thing, you know?
Squeak!
Very good sound effect. God, when you want this thing to squeak, it does.
Oh, that's good. We'll have to remember that next Halloween.
Yeah.
I will give you this description of the exhibition. It's a solo exhibition of the work of R.O. Bleckman, the prolific illustrator, cartoonist, author, and animator with 14 New Yorker covers and a Museum of Modern Art animated film retrospective to his credit. Bleckman has won many honors and awards, among them a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Cartoonists Society, an induction into the Society of the Illustrators Hall of Fame. He's a Hudson Valley resident. Mm. And I was suggesting that people go to look at his website, robleckman, BLECHMAN.com. The exhibition is going to be on view through May 11th. So I'm going to step outside the studio now.
Okay, don't step too far.
Okay, I'll be back. Carry on.
Yes, I will. I think I can manage without you. I don't know. It's rough. These are rough times. I'm looking forward to meeting Mr. Bleckman. Oh, I believe here he is.
Here he is.
Dun, 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 dun.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
No, no.
Okay.
You're right on time.
Okay.
Right on time.
Hi.
And this is Thomas
Hi.
Pietro.
Hello. You're going to get right on the, we're right on the air right now.
We're
so.
On the air. We're incorporating you into the show.
That's right.
What we said last have a seat here.
So we're setting Mr. Bleckman. Mr. Bleckman has joined the party. Ellen has given him the... And the key thing, Mr. Bleckman, is to get right on that microphone or else no one will ever hear you. Well, I've been even closer,
okay.
Please. There you go. Been really looking forward to meeting you. I knew you lived around here.
That's right, yes.
And as I was telling Ellen, a year or two ago, I was writing a piece on the magazine Humbug, and I saw one of your earliest... I believe one of your earliest contributions
no,
ever,
that's
right?
That's right. 1952.
That's
I was
right.
just out of college.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it just the one?
No.
Were there more than one, right?
No, actually, every single one.
Yeah.
I don't know how many issues. I guess there were about 10 or so
There was
issues.
Only 10 altogether.
Yeah. And I also did a cover, which, by the way, I later used for The New Yorker 20 years later.
Oh, right. I did know that. Yeah.
What was Humbug?
Humbug was a magazine. Well, I'll let Mr. Bleckman tell.
Well, it was founded by Harvey Kurtzman, who...
One of my heroes.
Yeah, was one of the founders of Mad Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to start his own magazine, which was terrific. It really was very distinctive in so many ways. Unfortunately, it folded, as so often happens with things that are distinctive in so many ways.
Did you contribute to any of his later projects, like Trump or Help?
Yeah. But Trump also was short-lived.
Two issues.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah?
Yeah, great shame.
And then Help, I think, was about 2 years worth of...
I must say that when Harvey Kurtzman died... there was an obit given by Spiegelman. And
in
I
The
attended.
New Yorker, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, actually, it was a
right.
memorial service.
Right. Sorry.
Or as they're called these days, celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody gets memorialized anymore. And I then realized, oh, my God, Harvey Kurtzman was really a great force in comics.
Yes.
Didn't appreciate it until it was pointed out to me.
Had you just submitted to Humbug, or had you been solicited, or how did you make that connection with Kurtzman?
I think he probably asked me.
Yeah. Now, he was amazing. I mean, he constantly cultivated new talent. And as I'm sure you know, that's partly how Spiegelman got involved. And R. Crumb did some of his very first work for Kurtzman at Help magazine.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to look through my old helps.
You got them?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. Sure.
I bet you have an archive that is pretty big.
Well, I've been around pretty long. So, yeah, sure.
So tell us about, where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn. Yeah. Lived there until I was 11 or 12. Then the war broke out, and my parents had B ration cards and felt that that wasn't enough gas to get them to Manhattan where they worked. God knows why they didn't take the subway. It would have been faster. And you don't need a ration card for that. So I guess I was... Manhattan was it. I mean, to what was called the city, you know, mm-hmm. Brooklyn not being mm-hmm. a part of the city. And that was my education to a great extent.
Did you go to the art high school?
Yeah, music and art high school. Yeah, and that also was transformative.
That's where Harvey went too.
That's right.
A whole bunch of great people went there. I mean, it's all those guys that Harvey cultivated, like Will Elder and all those cartoonists and everything.
That's right.
It was a real... amazing place.
A hotbed.
It was a hotbed, really. Because these were, you know, a lot of them were children of immigrant parents or whatever, and or whatever, and went to this great public school. Yeah. And then they cultivated their time.
At the time, I didn't appreciate it that much. Same with Oberlin College. I went there and didn't like it very much. And now I continually think of how great some of the courses were. But at the time, it passed me by. My son went there, and I attended some of his classes, and I could see that the school had gotten even better than when I went.
Yeah. Well, did you draw from a very early age?
Not well, no.
But it was what you were drawn to?
No, not really. No, I had no interest in art whatsoever. I mean, you know, I could copy Donald Duck, maybe. Save me from Mandrake the Magician, anything like that. Prince Valiant. I was just... it was a way of showing off. That's why I drew, you know. And my art classes in public school would be enough to turn any budding artist off. We had to bring the National Geographics and copy them. And I couldn't copy them very well. So when I did apply to music and art high school, my art teacher... didn't give me a recommendation. She didn't give me a disrecommendation, but she couldn't recommend me because I didn't know how to copy. So what kind of artist was I?
So how was music and art then? Was that a better experience?
Oh, yeah, it was great. But even then, I had no thought of becoming an artist. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I'd be. But I guess when I went to Oberlin, that was somewhat transformative because... I also didn't take any of the art classes, which is just as well. I think that would have turned me off. You know, the problem with college is you have to have an MA in order to teach art. And if you're an artist, why in the world are you going to go for an MA? You know, you're going to do this stuff. Now, where was I? So I did political cartoons for the college newspaper. And that kind of... pushed me into thinking, hey, maybe I could be a full-time cartoonist. But I think what really happened was that the Korean War was on, and I was about to be drafted. This is 1952 when I graduated. And since I wasn't called up right away, I thought, well, what the hell? Bleep? Can I use that word? I don't know.
Sure.
Okay, all right.
But don't go
stronger.
Much further.
Nothing's
I won't go much further. No.
Well, just because Ellen will have a heart attack.
Okay. And then if she has a heart attack, well, I can continually bleep, bleep, bleep all the time. She won't be hearing. I decided, I might as well see if I can sell some of this stuff. And I was able to. And... although God knows why, I couldn't draw well at all.
Well, that's, you know, kind of what always struck me about your work is that you're one of the first cartoonists to introduce a kind of minimalist squiggly line style.
Yeah.
And I would definitely emphasize, I mean, it's minimalist. You'd accept that, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's
sure.
You know.
And in a way, I get away from it quite a bit now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a show coming up at the Hudson Opera House. And I have some artwork there. I mean, things that really would make you wonder, who did this? What's it doing in Blechman's show?
Maybe you learned some things over the years.
I learned something about art.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't like the look of what I was doing. And also, I wasn't pushing myself. I wasn't using color, for example. Mm. I wasn't using a lot of media that I now use. I was about to say, not that I think of myself as an artist. Yeah, I'm an artist, along with a lot of other things.
But your cartooning was mainly black and white ink drawings, right?
Yeah, but in a way that's, how can I put this? That's a question of the media in which I work. You mm-hmm. work for the New York Times. Initially, they had no color.
Right.
So I did everything in black and white. And black and white is easier, let's face it. Mm. And also you can do a lot using just a black and white line. I mean, look at Steinberg. Look at so many of the... Well, look at the older New Yorker cartoonists. Even now, hey, the cartoons are all black and white. The mm-hmm. cartoons.
Right.
Except for Rose Quast.
Yeah, so, oh, yeah. She's amazing. Yeah.
Isn't she?
Oh, she's
you know, in
staggering.
Some ways, I would position you as kind of like the transition from the old school of Peter Arno to the newer cartoonists, at the, you know, the more recent cartoonists at The New Yorker, who seem more inspired by your work than, say, Peter Arno.
No, please don't lump me with the present New Yorker cartoonists.
Oh, no, I didn't say that. I said you inspired them. No.
No, no.
You don't like them. okay,
I'm looking for the words. Okay, no, they're not good. They're not good. That's a shame. And a lot of the old timers who are still around are not being used, and that's tragic. No, look at the stuff that was done in the 20s, 30s, 40s, even the 50s, up into the 60s and the 70s. In fact, up until the time Lee Lorenz left, which was when Tina Brown took it over, and. Let's leave it at that.
Did you happen to see 60 Minutes on Sunday night? There was...
I'm so glad I missed it.
The present
Bob Minkoff
was on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it showed him... it showed various cartoonists coming to him with work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he was just, you know, dismissing it one after the other.
It's a shame his work wasn't among those dismissed.
I have to agree. He's a very...
This stuff is no good.
It's not good. His writing can be good, but his...
His writing is good.
Right.
But his stuff is...
His drawings.
I mean, it's very impolitic of me to talk about a colleague this way. So, Bob Minkoff, if you happen to be in the area, forgive me.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about your process? I mean, there's so many ideas in your work that... if you were a songwriter, I would say which comes first, the music or the lyrics. But
yeah, no, it's the idea that propels it all.
Yeah,
yeah, I have an idea, and then I play it out, and it works or it doesn't work. And sometimes, thank God, I'm not a novelist, because if I had an idea and I wrote a novel, and a year or two later, I realize the damn thing doesn't work out. No, I mean, I do all sorts of sometimes crazy, far-out things. I'm almost tempted to talk about it, but I'm superstitious.
Mm.
No, I will. I'm taking an 18th century...
Nobody's listening, so just us.
Okay, so I can get back to Bob Minkoff. Okay. No, I have a few crazy ideas that on the face of it... shouldn't work out, and they seem to be working out, and I'll know when I'm finished that indeed they did work out, or I was right to be apprehensive it didn't work out. You never know. I mean, I'm doing a bunch of things for Wired magazine, and I'm thrilled that this 22nd century magazine called on this early 20th century guy, mid 20th century guy here. And how can I put it? Some of them worked out in my estimation, others didn't. But thank God the art director emailed me back saying they're all terrific. He's wrong. They're not all terrific. But
are these covers or?
No. A Wired magazine? No. No, these are spot illustrations. Uh-huh. A very difficult subject. I couldn't grab it. But actually, coming here by car, I thought of something that I think will work out. But, you know, the deadlines on these things are horrendous. Yesterday, I received an email that they wanted to see things today. That was yesterday. And here I am helping out with the show, mm-hmm. you know. And so I'm torn between these two things. The wise thing would have been to turn the job down. You know, you can only do one thing properly at a time. I'm no multitasker. Yet I couldn't turn down Wired, even though my fear was that I wouldn't come through, you know.
So
you never know.
They send you the article, and you have to come up with spot illustration ideas?
Yeah.
Like how many for that?
Four. I sent them six. And when I leave here, I'll send them a seventh, which I was thinking of when I came down here.
Well, that raises an interesting question. I remember reading an interview with Gahan Wilson where he said his favorite cartoons that he did were the ones that had no text. Do you sort of have that view, too, that you prefer kind of just a pure visual cartoon
no,
or illustrator?
No, not at all. Some things require text. Mm-hmm. Other things would be superfluous with text. I have no, you know, some things just read by themselves, other things don't. I tend to rely a lot on text. I seem to be oriented as much to the written word as the drawn image. But you know, I really should have been a filmmaker. I was hoping you would ask me about that.
Oh, we're getting to that.
I really should have been a filmmaker. You know, you look at my stuff, you see that, you know, my books, they move. And something struck me. Back in 1952, hey, this is a real story. Back in 1952, I was asked to illustrate the play Harvey by Mary Chase. And it was for the Oxford University Press. And what struck me looking at that book now was that it begins with three pages, maybe two pages of drawings before you get the title page. There's a sequence leading up to it. So even then, I was thinking cinematically. But here's the crazy thing. I was interviewed by the publicity director, and I never forgot the guy's face. Never forgot it, because it's such a distinctive face. And then about a year and a half ago, I happened to be in a grocery store, and I saw the guy. It turned out to be John Ashbery. And I didn't know John Ashbery from, you know.
Well,
but I knew the face.
52.
Now, we're talking about something 50 good years later. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, really.
Were
is.
You in the grocery store? Here in
Hudson?
Yeah,
it was on, it was, I shouldn't call
in
it
New
a grocery
York?
Store. No, here.
Oh.
In the neighborhood, yeah.
Huh.
And the wild thing is, I recognized the guy, you know? I didn't. Well, I think I might have known that it was John Ashbery, because, you know, his picture has been around. Yeah. I recognize the picture, I just don't recognize the poetry. No, it's a tough going, you know, you have to work. And I'm a lazy reader.
I'm not sure it yields anything in the long run anyway, but that's a whole nother. Much as you don't like Bob Mankoff's work, I have doubts about John Ashbery's poetry.
Let me ask you something. How is it that you have apparently an interest in cartooning?
Oh, I've written pieces about comics and illustrators. And
oh, really?
Yeah. And in fact, I'm currently doing a book about this cartoonist I like a lot named Ben Cachor.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, isn't he great?
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, no, I've had this interest for quite a while. And one of my, I mean, I went out of my way to collect everything by Harvey Kurtzman at one point.
Really?
You know, because I just love this stuff.
Yeah. You probably know a hell of a lot more than I do because, I know him from Humbug and Trump, but I didn't know his past, and I didn't appreciate him all that much. Mm-hmm. He was a good editor.
My interest in cartoons and comics, of course, cartoons comes from, you know, looking at the New Yorker cartoons when I was a kid, but the comics thing, I never read DC or Marvel comics, so my whole education in comics was the kind of alternative style that came out of EC and all the, you know, Mad Magazine, and then the underground cartoonists, so I never really polluted myself with all that DC,
you know, it's
Marvel
wild.
Junk.
Back in the 50s, late 50s, maybe early 60s, I happened to come across the stuff of a cartoonist called Robert Crumb. I saw a sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching then at the School of Visual Arts, so I should know what the year was. But in any event, I couldn't believe this stuff. What I also couldn't believe was that, you know, if I had asked him, hey, could I have one of your things? He would say, are you joking? You want it? Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that came back to haunt him later on.
Wasn't there?
Did it? Why it came back?
Yeah, because he never really protected his copyrights.
And oh, I always had a feeling about Robert Crumb, and this goes way, way back. That the people who could have helped him and who were good for him and his career, he rejected, and he allied himself with people who were no good. For example, when Fritz the Cat he went with Ralph Bakshi. I happen to admit that I didn't see the film, but still, he should have been involved,
right?
Somewhat, you know. It turned out to be a good film. I'm told, and I'm sure that was the case. But I had that strong feeling that he wasn't his own best friend.
Yeah,
a lot of cartoonists are like that.
There was a film made about him, wasn't there? About
A couple years ago.
I don't remember the name of it, but it seems to me there were three Robert Crumbs. There was the real Robert Crumb. There was an actor playing Robert Crumb.
You're confusing that with the Harvey Pekar movie.
Oh, okay.
But actually, you got to know his...
Brothers,
and wow.
Wow.
What a scene.
Yeah,
what
exactly.
A scene. Actually, I called Robert Crumb. Did I call or did I email him? No, I emailed him a short while ago. Sent him some of my books, hoping he would send me back some of his books. He sent me back an email lamenting the fact that he's 70 years old, which for me is, hey, you're a kid. But he's been living in France,
yes,
you know,
in southern France.
And not speaking much French. And apparently enjoying it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Fantagraphics Books in California, or actually they're in Washington State now, sort of gathered him in and produced the 17-volume set of his work. And
really?
They kind of worked with him to help raise money, for one thing, because he was broke at one point and had big tax problems and all this kind of stuff. So I think he's doing okay now.
Oh, I'm sure he is. Yeah, how can he not?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but I have a Robert Crumb cartoon, and it is going to be put up for auction. What happened is that I had him over for dinner when 1969.
Wow.
Boy, I can remember a date. I can't believe it. 1952, I remember, because I graduated college. But I had him for dinner. At one point, after my wife said, okay, dinner's ready, I told Robert, dinner is served. And he didn't come right up for dinner. He did a drawing of me very stiffly saying, dinner is served. So I finally decided, what the hell? Why not sell it?
Yeah, right.
Lying around.
You've been published in France, too, haven't you?
Sure. I've been published a lot of places. Yeah, France. I have a good connection in France.
Yeah.
Well, and France has always had a tradition of appreciating cartoon art and comic art more
exactly.
so than here.
Exactly.
And treating it more seriously.
Exactly. In 1968, I had a one-man exhibit in Paris, and it was given by a guy called Delpierre, who is the publisher of a book of my stuff. So
you've published quite a few books here, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
including the one that's sitting in front of us here, Dear James.
Yes, I picked this up at the Opera House today.
Oh, I'll be damned. May I look at it?
Sure.
Hey, I never knew there was a paper. Oh, this isn't a paperback. This is a paperback.
Yeah.
When the hell did this come out? Yeah, it was very badly distributed. Shame. Very badly.
Well, I noticed there's a blurb from John Ashbery
we'll
on the back,
to.
Too.
Yeah, I was amazed. I was amazed.
We'll try to make up for that here in Hudson, New York. I did want to read something, though, about... I picked it up today, and I read over while I was eating my soup, read the first few pages, and I was really taken with this because...
you want to get the full title, Alan, before we...
It's called Dear James, Letters to a Young Illustrator by R.O. Bleckman. I want to tell a little story, though, first. I actually worked with Bob Bleckman on a postcard, an oversized postcard that we did for the Furthermore Foundation here in Hudson.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, it's a map of the Hudson River Historic District.
That's right.
And at one point I said, well, one thing is left out here, and that is we haven't put the Catskill Mountains in. So with three strokes of the pen, I think it was, suddenly the Catskills appeared. It was just three lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Three of the little squiggly lines. talk about being a minimalist. In this book, you're talking to James, and you say... let me say as an overall comment, without going into details, and very simply, that I like your work. I like its modesty. I like what's not said that doesn't need to be said. You get your ideas across with just enough to feed the eye as well as the mind. You draw a jacket, and there are no buttons, no cuffs, no collar, but there it is, a jacket that reads as a jacket and satisfies as a drawing. Its simplicity shows respect for the viewer. You don't give more than what the mind needs, nor less than what the eye deserves.
I wrote that?
You did.
Hey, I like it.
It's nice, isn't
thank
it?
You.
You know,
thank
you.
And it describes your work, though.
I guess it does, yeah.
It does indeed.
And it brings up an interesting question, I think, that what's it like dealing with editors of cartoons and illustration? Is that...
It depends on the editor. Yeah. I've had some bad experiences, terrible experiences. The worst was when I did work for a national publication. I won't give the name. The art director said, "Hey, this stuff is perfect," his words. And the editor threw everything out. And I think... and I'm sure I'm right, that my work either matched or trumped the text. And being an editor, he was very text fixated. Mm-hmm. I really think that. Incidentally, the editor lost his job.
Mm.
I lost the job, too. It's a shame. But hey, on the whole, I don't know. I can't speak freely.
Yeah.
You know, I'm right. And I'm thinking of some editors who I think are brilliant wordsmen, but they're
both,
not visual.
Yeah. Mm. Both Kurtzman and Gayan Wilson often said that Hugh Hefner was a superb cartoon editor.
Wow. Well, that's
because surprising. You know he was a wannabe cartoonist.
Ah, well, sometimes that can be terrible because what happened is sometimes a wannabe cartoonist a wannabe cartoonist reviewed that book in the New York Times.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Need I say more? a wannabe cartoonist... I'm being terribly indiscreet.
That's all right.
Well, it's all right for you. you don't mind my being indiscreet. I've had problems where wannabe cartoonists have become art directors, and that was the end of my relationship with the publication.
Oh, boy.
You know, there's a lot of jealousy out there. There's a lot of jealousy everywhere, for God's sakes. I mean, I'm jealous, too, but I don't act on it, you know. There are a lot of people who act on their jealousy, and it's very tough. Well, Schadenfreude, you know, yeah. That's a way of cutting people down.
You were in the comic pages of National Lampoon, weren't you? Or?
No.
No, you weren't?
Oh, I think I had maybe two things,
oh,
max,
okay.
With a Lampoon. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think people are going to be surprised at the show at the Opera House. I was there today, and I saw what was going up, and it's very interesting
stuff. Well,
thank
you. Thank you. Yeah.
Have you ever, I know you've done animation. Have you ever tried to do a feature-length animation?
Yeah, still trying.
Yeah, it's hard to.
As I say in one of the captions, and I'm not giving up. I'm only 83 years old, so you know this time. It's a long and sad story. I should have been a full-time filmmaker. I really should have been, and I had plenty of opportunities, and I gave them up ridiculously. I mean, at one point, I got a telephone call from. The wife of the guy who did Curious George, H.A. Mm-hmm. Rye, however you pronounce his name. Yeah. She wanted me to do a feature, and I said no. And that was because it happened just after I did my Stravinsky thing. That's what I think might have been going through my mind. At least it's what I hope was a somewhat legitimate excuse. But that would have been my entree. I would have just, I'd be... This interview would be taking place in Beverly Hills, California. No, really. It's just one of those missteps. We all make them. That was mine. Yeah.
But the Stravinsky film won an Emmy, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But it should have been the beginning of a career.
Yeah,
and it's the last thing I did. It was done well over 20 years ago. And, I started one thing, Candide, not Bernstein's Candide, but Voltaire's Candide, and my storyboard wasn't that right, and so I kind of gave it up after doing 20 minutes of good film. What I did then is I sat down one evening and I recut it. It worked. But by then, I was too tired. I no longer had an animation studio. I've had an animation studio for 29 years, but I ran into some problems with it. And so for a variety of reasons, I was tired. I didn't have the animation backup. I never went back to it. And I wish I had. But, you know, very often at the end, towards the end of a project, the thing snaps together, as a lot of theatrical people know. You know, dress rehearsal suddenly, wham.
Or when you're driving your car down the streets of Hudson.
Good for you, Ellen. Good for you. Now, I had an interesting experience that confirmed that for me. I had seen a stage play by Julie Taymor.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was at the very, very, very beginning of a career, and it was in an off Broadway show. And it was fabulous. And I turned to the person who invited me. She was the publicity director. And I said, God, that was fabulous. And she said, yeah, but it wasn't last night, or maybe two nights ago. It, at the very end, pulled together. And that was my experience also. And I think a lot of people give up prematurely.
Yeah.
You have to watch it.
Didn't help with Spider-Man.
Sorry. Well, Julie Taymor is a very interesting person. Yeah. She actually did a feature film before...
Her Shakespeare?
What was her first feature film?
Lion King?
No, she had a Shakespeare movie.
Oh, yeah, Coriolanus. Yeah. No, not Coriolanus. Andronicus, yes. Or something like that.
Titus Andronicus.
Hey, she had done a feature film before, which I saw at a preview. Uh-huh. It was dreadful. It was dreadful. But she did what I wish I had, which was to pick herself up and go on.
Yeah.
No, she wouldn't be... I shouldn't knock her. I don't mean to. But without the Bread and Puppet Theater, there wouldn't be a Julie Taymor.
Mm-hmm.
She learned from them. But Bread and Puppet Theater.
The Goddard.
They're a bunch of bums.
Yeah.
Because they're brilliant, they're geniuses, and they've never really gone on to... I think they're too anti-societal or whatever. Mm-hmm.
They come to town here.
Yeah, they're great.
They're here
they
every
were.
Year.
Yeah. They were. You know, maybe, and they still are.
Yeah.
But they're really equipped for a much larger audience than they've managed. But again, I think they choose not to be in the mainstream, which hurts all of us.
Yeah.
You know.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but I have to announce that you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM on your dial or WGXC.org. And we have the privilege today, Ellen and I, of talking to R.O. Blackman, the distinguished cartoonist, illustrator, animator, and soon, that is to say, in two days, having a show at the Hudson, begins at the Hudson Opera House on Saturday at...
From 5 to 7
is the reception,
and the show will be up through May 11th.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Wow, that's good news.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I wanted to ask you about, you have, your son's name is Nicholas?
Yes.
Is that right?
Correct.
You have just one son?
No, I have two sons.
You have two.
One is in Paris, and the other is in Brooklyn.
And the one in Brooklyn is also an illustrator, isn't he?
Illustrator, art director. He art directs the book review.
Of the New York Times.
Oh, right. Because you did a dialogue at one point, locally, I believe, talking about...
Oh, at the Norman Rockwell Museum.
So he has several careers. He also does a little bit of animation. He does a column on food, which appears in print, and also there's an animated version, appears. Yeah.
It rubbed off a little bit.
Well,
sounds like more than a little.
Not a lot.
No, it rubs off on me also because, you know, he has certain skills that I don't have. So I take advantage of what he can give to me, as I hope I can occasionally give things to him. Yeah. You know, very often to have a well-known father, at least in the Blackman family, I'm well known, can be bad. My wife, for example, is extraordinarily visual. And yet her parents were both artists. And could you believe that her mother was competitive to her, if you can imagine something as obscene as that? And... it kind of hurt my wife. She was a brilliant designer for Barney's New York, and I always...
She was a fashion designer?
Brilliant fashion designer. Brilliant, brilliant. She had her own line, her own department, and it became competitive to Barney's. And they said, these are the colors that you have to use this year, and also, get a load of this, buttons are in. I want you to put a lot of buttons. She said, well, what do you want me to put the buttons? You're the designer. So she put a lot of buttons on her her suits, mostly. And she used the colors, and it didn't sell well. And they said, oh, we're terribly sorry. Your line didn't do that well. So that was the end of it. And she became a private couture. And, but in any event, sometimes it's not very good when your parents are, certainly if you're competitive, but that's unusual. But sometimes you don't have to be competitive, just the fact that there's this, well, Virginia Woolf said she never would have become a published author if her father hadn't died. Hello? So, you know. And I'm sure he was encouraging to her, but his presence was so vast that it kind of overwhelmed her. Yeah.
Well, what have we left out here? There's so much to say and talk about. But primarily, I want to urge people to come to the exhibition because I think it's a real treat for the eye and the mind.
And Ellen, I noticed we've been so engaged by this that we forgot to play the headlines, so I got to do that.
Oh, okay. Okay. And so come back anytime.
All right, thank you. Thank you.